we're going to start with Anne. Just tell us your title, workplace, and just a brief summary of what you do.
I am at the University of North Texas. I am at the University of North Texas, a professor of anthropology, retired August 31st, so to be a professor emeritus. And in the anthropology department, which is an all-applied department, and we have a master's program, an applied master's program, two versions of it. One is on campus, students come to us, the other is online, and it's the same program we just offered in two contexts, the online one being for students all around the world who are not able to come to us, and students who are have professional jobs places and are not able to quit and come to us. So we have an online master's. I am an organizational anthropologist, so I'm part of our business anthropology focus. We have, well, anyway, several focuses. Anyway, that's so. Organizations are my particular specialty.
Great. I should say North Texas is an excellent program. At least half of my committee is made up of students from North Texas, so you have a very sharp group. So thank you for sending them our way. So my question to you is, let's start where we all started, with graduate school. And again, this program, this panel is really, we're looking a little bit back, but more towards the future. Where are we? NAPA's 30 years old. How far has the practice of anthropology come? And then what is to come for us? So let's dial back to where we started with grad school. What do students need to know now to thrive as practitioners? And are they getting it, as far as you know, in their graduate programs?
Those are the two questions Terry gave me, and I felt a little under-equipped to answer them. So I sent out an email to our student listserv, which includes our past students and our present students, and asked them to answer those questions for me. And I said, this is not specifically about our program, but about what you need as practitioners to thrive. And so I got back a lot of very useful answers, and that's what I'm going to share with you, is what the students said. The first thing they said was experience in real projects. But that is, one student to quote said, students need to practice before they can actually practice anthropology. And that, you know, you get the pure theoretical, and they need the translation process between the clean and the dirty. I kind of hated that one of the students used those terms, but you know what she's talking about. And that can be hard to do well. That it's those projects they have in school that then they are then able to put on their resumes and in their cover letters to show that they have experience. So in getting jobs, they need to have had those. So that's how we got jobs, was because we had those experiences that we could talk about. And in addition, when you go to the interviews, you have those things to talk about, the experience that you had. They spoke about two kinds of projects, the thesis project, which is hopefully a project where they have to get their own client, and they have to create the project with the client, see the project all the way through to the conclusion, work with the client constantly through it. So that's one kind of project. The other kind of project are class projects, where they're working in groups, again for real clients. All of it needs to be for real clients, not fake stuff, where they're working in a class group for a client. And those have different kinds of values. And what they get from that, one of the things is the confidence when they actually get out and they're actually in the workforce, because confidence that they can trust their own judgment. They've already had these experiences, they can trust their own judgment. They said, when we get out there, it is frequently we're the only anthropologist in a project, you know, with other people, as you're all aware. And so you need to be able to trust in yourself that you can stick to your guns, and you know when to fight for something and when to give up on it, and can trust your own judgment. So it's those projects that give them that kind of ability to trust, the confidence to trust themselves. They also said lots of quantitative. Of course, we all, qualitative is our specialty, and that is, of course, valuable, but they also need the quantitative. A lot of jobs require quantitative. What research jobs typically expect is that you're going to have had a lot of quantitative. Other social scientists have a lot of quantitative. And so it's not uncommon to have a job require 6 hours of quantitative. and that you need two kinds. You need the sort of basic math-based quantitative course, which gives you the skills to do the various kinds of work, but doesn't necessarily give you the context. And then you need the anthropological quantitative course that says, okay, here's how you use those, and this is the context in which you use them. So you need the anthropological perspective, so two kinds of sort of approaches to it. Let's see. Software knowledge, general project management, like Microsoft Visio. I don't even know what that is. I don't know if I pronounced that right. OmniPlan, and of course Evernote, Excel, Adobe if you're doing design. That even in a low-tech company, people expect you to have those, already have those skills. And if you know that stuff, then that gives you street cred in the office. So it's useful for that. Managerial skills, developing management leadership skills. Those are vital for being able to move around in an organization. While you may not be immediately going into a leadership management position, but it allows you to have the flexibility and the value and to move around in an organization that are useful to you. Then project skills. How to run a research project from start to finish. How to balance client demands and asks with keeping true to the anthropological way. Report writing for real clients as opposed, of course, to the academic thing. How to present research approaches and findings. How to work with other disciplines. One student said that's key, and it's especially valuable if you've had projects in school where you, for example, a class where it's where you work with design students, or a design class where you work with anthro students and design students. Those classes where you have to work with students on projects who are from another discipline helps you learn how to do that. One student said, I'm currently on a project where the project manager is a psychologist and I'm exhausted. So if they already had some of that practice in school, that helps them. How to make research insights actionable for clients, of course. And time management, how to run projects in a timely manner. And then the interdisciplinary, which I've already mentioned, and presentation experience. Job market, several of them mentioned that translation. And I got more of these comments from the students who are still in than from those who are already out. They're worried about will they have the translation skills, how to translate from the academic environment to market what they know. Networking, encourage your students to engage with professional organizations. They said, establish a network of peers and mentors who are already thriving as practitioners. And learn how to connect online with LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, blogging, all those networks. Give you real-world opportunities for jobs. And, of course, obviously they all talked about the theory base, but in terms of thriving as a practitioner, these are the things you have to need beyond that. So the second part of the question, are they getting what they need? These are the things they told me students need. And, if they're getting all of those things, then my answer would be, I suppose, yes. They said to me the most important thing is the projects. The class projects are gold, and the class projects for real clients, and then the thesis project where they have to develop their own client, see the project all the way, that gives them all those project management skills that they're going to need. So the class projects and the projects are gold. That's the most important thing. And let's see. And that they need not just the individual project, but the group projects in school, because the group projects help them understand how to work with other people. The individual projects, that it's very rare and unusual that you're going to actually be an individual person working on an individual project. So the group projects have to give you those group skills. I suspect a lot of programs are doing well at that. I don't know if we're doing as well with the professional skills. One student who's now at Cambridge said they're in a PhD program. They have they take a lot of short training professional skills courses. They have to have a certain number of hours, and so they've got these little mini courses, which could be Photoshop, public presentation, all kinds of things, and that those help them develop those other kinds of skills. it seems to me, in addition to in thinking about this, there are things for us to tap for our students that we may not be tapping. For example, evaluation skills. All our graduates, our applied students, are really developing evaluation skills in our program, but they don't really understand how to call themselves evaluators. So encouraging them to go to the evaluation meetings, where they will come to understand how they could fit into that environment. And so selling themselves as an evaluator with the terminology that they need, those kinds of things. And we need to be stretching them into these other kinds of professional organizations that we fit into beautifully, but they may not know how to do it. So encouraging them to get involved in those other kinds of organizations, I think, helps increase their marketability. I also have to say that I think NAPA just really does some great stuff. From the mentoring program to Neil and Kathleen's
Career Expo,
which I've had to applaud them. They have done that for so many years, so tirelessly, and that is a great opportunity for students. That is a wonderful opportunity. So, you know, NAPA
does...
It
was Dennis's idea, but just...
Thank you, Dennis.
Just credit, credit can
Dennis
be
will applaud
applied,
Dennis.
Right,
yeah, thank you.
So, I think that NAPA does a lot of key things to help the students along. And finally, one of our students said, could you plug a session that we're doing at SFAA, which is 9 current students from 9 explicitly applied programs from the U.S. and Mexico who are talk about why they chose their applied programs, what they like about them, and what they'd like to improve. And I don't know the title of the session. The student's name is Molly Shea, and that's going to be at SFAA also.
Okay, sure.
I'd like to, I really appreciate your comprehensive list. I'd like to amplify one thing that Anne said, which was that anthropologists should be really good at communication because they understand brokering cultural barriers, but I find them terrible at doing so. I can't even read some of my own colleagues' works. I have trouble even reading my own work when I'm a graduate student. I worked at the CDC and I've been there for 28 years. And one of the things I had to learn when I arrived was how to write in English. And writing in English is a very useful skill. As a matter of fact, I just ran across this book in the bookstore yesterday. It's called The Elements of Fucking Style. And it was a revision of a book that was first published in 1918. And I'm going to give it to my daughters because they might not read the original, but they'll probably read this one. But anyway, communication in ordinary English is so important in applied fields because other people just don't understand anthropologies, and I have trouble understanding myself. I think that writing and rewriting and getting students to write well is something they can't do without.
And let me just dovetail both of those as well. If you are, particularly if you're an educator, the popular survey in 2009 of master's degree students, a lot of what Anne said dovetails with what students said. This is a few years after, up to many years after the graduate school, saying what they need, what they use, what they need, what they didn't get. Those are so the changing face of anthropology. If you Google that, the changing face of anthropology, at AAA will take you to that PDF document. So Robert, let's since we're with you, can you give us a summary of what you do at the CDC? And then we'll go into your even lengthier question.
I've done a lot of different things. I started out in a program called the Epidemic Intelligence Service, which I just tried to peddle to graduate students at the Career Expo. It's a 2-year training program for PhDs and actually mostly MDs, but it has taken a lot of anthropologists. And they end up working for 2 years in CDC programs, and then CDC actually recruits many of its staff from this program. I ended up working in sexually transmitted diseases, which is not at all where I expected to go. But it turned out to be very interesting and productive, and I learned a lot. Some things I didn't want to see, but very interesting anyway. And then I got a a regular job at CDC, and I ended up, I've done a lot of things that are kind of borderline between epidemiology and anthropology, which is what I want to do. A couple of things that I've done there, particularly related to anthropology, in 1993 I was asked to help found a group called the Behavior and Social Science Working Group, which I did, and it's been a very active group, not only of multiple disciplinary behavioral sciences, which brings trainings to CDC, which brings talk speakers to CDC, which communicates about personnel needs for behavioral scientists to the personnel departments, which communicates with the leadership about the benefits of behavioral sciences at CDC. I spent a year in Congress trying to understand how policy uses and abuses science in decision making. For the past 12 years, I've worked on a project called the Guide to Community Preventive Services, where we synthesize evidence on different public health topics. So I worked for 6 years trying to find out what works to prevent juvenile violence, violence by and against juveniles, things like school programs, anti-violence programs, or what you do for kids who've been exposed to trauma. So we synthesize evidence, we put out reports, we hope that people pick these up. I spent about 5 years looking at how the government classifies race and ethnicity, which is quite a bizarre story. And as you might imagine, different agencies define things differently, and they share each other's data, so what the result is questionable. I was part of the a body that helped revise the Office of Management and Budget Directive 15 that establishes federal policy on the classification of race and ethnicity, and they didn't listen to me. Mm-hmm. So they're still doing essentially what they were doing before. Well, they do now allow people to identify multiple race, which actually adds a lot of confusion to the system. I've also been part of the COPAPIA project. I've worked a lot with the AAA. I've been fortunate in being funded to do work with the AAA, so I worked on a race project for 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. Because of my work on racial classification, it was a great project. I worked with COPAPIA trying to establish the role of applied sciences, applied anthropology as a solid part of anthropology. I just bumped into a graduate school colleague of mine who said that he was disappointed that his he interviewed so many people for his position. He said they were such good students. I said, why don't you send them to work in applied anthropology? He said, oh, they don't want to be second-class citizens. So I was really disappointed to hear that. On the other hand, 2 weeks ago I attended a meeting here in D.C. where about 40, 50 anthropologists were invited by the AAA, sponsored by Leonard Grand, to think about how anthropologists can help in the Ebola response. Mm-hmm. And this was the largest public health response organized by the AAA in its history. At the same time, the CDC has established an anthropology desk in the Ebola response, and they are asking the AAA to help them communicate and learn about anthropological issues in this disastrous event. And so next week, Ed Liebau is coming to the CDC, and we're going to have him meet with some of the leadership in epidemiology, health promotion, and logistics, and the Ebola response. So, I see positive and negative trends in the connection between public health and anthropology. I don't know if I answered your question.
Well, the real question, in 5 minutes or less, is what do you see as the future of medical anthropology?
Well, medical anthropology is many things. My own focus has been on linking anthropology and public health, and I see that as a very vibrant process. And this recent connection between anthropology and the AAA and CDC has been just the epitome of that for me. And I see this, I mean, what we're trying to establish with Vibo, and it actually is a woman coming to arrive tonight from UNMEER, who's the UN emergency response effort coordinating all of the UN agencies in dealing with Ebola. The deputy director is a medical anthropologist. So, I mean, and she's coming to CDC also next week. So, I mean, it's just, this convergence is just exactly what I've been trying to establish. What we're trying to do is to not only make this work for Ebola, so there's a listserv which has about 50 to 100 anthropologists on it who mostly work in West Africa. And any public health person can say, well, tell me about cremation practices in Lufa County in Liberia. And they can get, in 2 days, they will have a series of answers of how people dispose of bodies in this place. Or, you know, tell me about the agricultural cycle in so-and-so. So it's going to be a fabulous thing once it gets going. And what we're trying to do is establish this not only for the Ebola event, but as a standard way of linking anthropology into public health for other crises that they may, and not only crises, but what are not perceived as crises in the future. Medical anthropology more broadly, I'm not sure, I don't know what's going on in more medical settings. I assume that anthropologists are still working in those, but I'm less in touch with that activity.
No, but the Ebola thing is an excellent case study, perhaps, we can see on how that interactions really ideally trying to get us. I'm glad to see that's all happening. Great, thanks. Timothy, workplace
yes.
Title, brief summary of what you do, and then we'll get to your question.
I just made the shift to academia. I started in 1997, got my newly minted PhD, was excited and eager to go out to be an academic anthropologist, and couldn't find a job. It's a story we've all come across. So I did my field work in Spain. I was I'm an ex-dancer, so I studied flamenco. That was my dissertation. Anyhow, it was an interesting topic, but couldn't find work in that. But I had contacts. I sent out resumes to headhunters, and in New York, this was the wave of account planning, if anyone knows, in advertising. So account planning is a function in advertising at the account side that really brings the consumer inside the agency and has their own work of understanding what consumers are about. So I got hired as an account planner. I wasn't an anthropologist, so to speak, but I kind of had my PhD badge underneath my shirt. And worked as an account planner for a number of years in New York, and then I went out to Detroit and worked on Cadillac as a planner. And then BBDO Advertising in New York hired me in 2003 as to have cultural insights group. So I ran that in BBDO for 9-10 years. And then I just switched over now to full-time. I work at Fordham Business School, teach marketing, consumer insights, and things like that. So another thing, though, we just hosted. My question was the future of, does EPIC represent the future of practice? So a little background here. EPIC, I hope you all know about Ethnographic Practice and Industry Conference. It started in 2004, 2005 with Intel, Microsoft, Ken Anderson, and Tracy Lovejoy, and it's been going on for about 10 years now. So we hosted this at Fordham Business School. It was very exciting. We hosted it this year. I'm so glad that's over. I was a chair this year, and you have a 2-year commitment. So I was a chair last year in London, and a chair this year, a co-chair at Fordham. And you learn a lot about EPIC from, I guess, behind the scenes too. So answering your question or responding to it, I would say that yes, in a lot of ways, EPIC is the future practice of anthropology in ways. One thing that's really neat is we're all here anthropologists. We talk among anthropologists. We kind of circulate among ourselves. It's kind of enclosed. EPIC brings all kinds of people together that you probably never meet before. So You have people in engineering, science, experienced researchers, user experience researchers, designers, design thinking, social psychology. And it's all about our work has to be useful. EPIC is making the work useful because it's mostly for corporations. EPIC is a combination of industry and academia. So it's probably 60% industry and 40% academia. But it's all about making our practice effective, how it works for corporations. So what unites us is this purpose. And also, one of the things I've realized about EPIC is that it brings in new ways of thinking about what we do. It's about pushing boundaries. So I might be killed for saying this, but I think a lot of anthropology looks at the present and looks back. And EPIC is purposeful looking forward. So because it's related to industry, it has to be future-oriented. So it's looking for disruptive thinking. Typically brings disruptive thinking in and really shakes up things. Sometimes it's looking back in the past. We had this as a panel. One of the panels was views of anthropology using Turner and Geertz on symbols and Malinowski and systems of magic. The person to my right presented a great paper on systems of magic, Brian. So we sometimes re-examine old ways of thinking about anthropology, but also it's pushing boundaries into looking at new subjects like big data, workplace configurations, space, place in the city, the quantified self, mindfulness. These are topics that are looked at. They're popular in business, and they're also looked at EPIC. So you're getting somewhat anthropological, but also other theories that came in to talk about practice and how we're making sense of this. So it's highly relevant. It's new ways of thinking. Not all anthropologists. I think that's very valuable. Also, not only like the AAA, but I think more so, the range of activities beyond lectures and papers. So EPIC takes place in one unified spot where our conferences. I think that's missing here. I'm sad to see millions of rooms and whatnot. So it's hard to get a sense of who we are all together. But EPIC, you do have that sense, a literal space and place sense of who we are, because you have the central conference place. And, there are different formats from the keynote speakers that come in. This year we had Thomas Frank, who was very controversial, that got a lot of flack about bringing him in. If any of you remember, he's a journalist. Media, popular journalism. He wrote PhD in history. He wrote a critique about anthropology as for sale about 15 years ago. So some of the anthropologists who he commented on were there. that brought up a sore spot. But it was great. He started talking about medical practices and industry and how we have to better shape this. We had a keynote from an educator, Dawn Lerman, who is a dean at the Fordham Business School, and she talked about how new techniques of flipping the classroom, how that's works with humanistic approaches. We had a speaker from Microsoft and a speaker from Red, the founder of Red Industries as well. Then there's also, you have the papers, we have the Pecha Kucha, which are the fast visual presentations, workshop. A number of people in here ran the workshops, salons, which are very interactive, very much like this. So the many formats in themselves create this different types of engagement, different types of learning experiences, very hands-on for a lot of students. We have a student practicum as well, where students are taught for a whole day by people in the industry that work with them. So they're developing their projects, their PhDs, their masters, they're working on these courses. So I think that kind of interactive format, the new ideas, the hybridity of bringing in new thinking is very much applied as a feature of practice.
Great. And for those of you, shame on you if you don't know what EPIC is, but if you don't, just Google EPIC conference and prepare to be amazed, because all of the prior sessions are all there. It's all archived. It's just the speakers, the topics, and things. It's dynamic.
If you go to epicpeople.org, it has a lot of things archived.
Yes.
And you can download that for free.
Paper
is in.
Yeah, AnthroSource has the papers. So through AnthroSource, you can read all the papers.
And I encourage you to very much do that, especially if you're a newer professional looking, you know, to see what your future might be. Brian, there you are. It's your turn. Yeah, exactly. So quickly, title, workplace, a summary of what you do on a weekly basis, let's say.
Hi, I've been told I'm supposed to speak about the rest of the world.
So here's the question. Our token anthropologist, yeah, your perspective on the future of anthropological practice occurring outside of the U.S. So you've been in the way of the world now upon your personal shoulder.
I'm sorry that I'm here, and I'm sorry that I'm talking, because I actually have no idea what to say.
Well, you live outside the U.S.
So thank you for inviting me. I am in fact a professor of business anthropology at the Copenhagen Business School, but I never go there. mainly because my wife got rid of me, so I had to go somewhere else. So I'm now living in Hong Kong, and I'm an honorary professor in Hong Kong and teach global creative industries. So that's who I am, and my name is Brian Moron. From a European point of view, and I'm interested in business anthropology, I do not understand how anthropology cannot study business, given that the limited stock company is the most pervasive form or organizational form in the world, other than a kinship system. And corporations very often a kinship system itself. So I don't see how anthropology cannot study corporations and related business activities. And until it does so, then there's something seriously wrong with it. So having said that, I then sort of think about how people in Europe go about studying anthropology. And of course, most of them are like American anthropologists. They just get a great business and don't think it's important because you're making money, and money is not a good thing, and you should do something pure and all that kind of nonsense. But there are places where anthropologists come in to study business. In my own field, which is Japan, of course, you know, Tom Raveen back in 1974 studied Japanese bank as an anthropologist, and Ron Dorr, the great, absolutely fantastic anthropologist, sociologist, studying British factory, Japanese factory. So the anthropology of Japan actually leads the way in the study of business organizations, although because Japan is on the periphery, it's never discussed in central anthropological theories, which is sort of, you know, you get a kind of double marginalization, one for business and one because it's Japan. Who wants to know about that? And I'm sorry I came here, because I really felt I had to have one drink before I came here. That makes me a little bit forgetful.
there's a backup box.
There's more?
I've drunk already one bottle. In Scandinavia, where I've been working for 15 years and have survived, it's quite interesting, I think. There is actually sort of pockets of business anthropology and people who have tried to move outside the sort of standard mainstream old-style anthropology. The trouble with Europeans is that Napa to us means wine. so we're not conversant with a lot of what goes on in America. And you say, see, I mean, I have no idea still what CBC is. So we are rather different cultural beings. And I think somehow we need to bridge that gap. My feeling is, excuse me for saying so, but my feeling is that in the noughties, so the 2000s, when you had that incredibly wonderful president, George W. I think you got very introverted. You didn't look outside and what was going on in Europe, and I still feel that. I still feel when I read material written by Americans that they're not reading what's going on in Europe. I think that's very sad, because I think Scandinavians and Brits actually do some quite interesting work. Of course, it's not, it's a bit of a generalization, specific people do read, but to get the feeling that America becomes the center and all of us must link up with you, but I think you need to reach out a bit, which you have done with me, so thank you. You may regret it, but that's another matter. I think there's sort of a difference how to cross that boundary. I think I urge you, at least I don't in a way, I urge you to attend the European Association of Social Anthropology. Their meetings where they have plenary sessions and panels, at least there are a few plenary sessions and panels you've been at. And it's a different kind of atmosphere, isn't it? It's not quite a sort of, I don't know how to describe the AA, American Alcoholics Anonymous. As I said, in Scandinavia there's quite a lot of pockets of people beginning to study business anthropology or related consumer. Eric Arnold has now moved to the University of Southern Denmark. There's things going on that are quite interesting. The other thing about Scandinavians is that they're writing English but in a second language, and therefore they don't write jargon. Very good. So I recommend that you actually read these foreigners who write things, because you can actually understand what they're saying. Whereas if you read Marilyn Strathern, you have absolutely no idea what is going on, unless you happen to be from Cambridge and have been taught by her. So are you here, Marilyn? I think engagement, therefore, is very important. Engagement across, you know, between the American, across the transatlantic pond. But another kind of engagement that I think is really important is that anthropologists get out of anthropology. In the case of business anthropology, we have to get into the business schools. And we have to be able to communicate with people in management studies or strategic blah, 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 or marketing, etc. And I've been trying to do this recently. I edit an open access journal of business anthropology, and I've been trying to do that in the most recent issue, which came out
a couple of days ago,
in which, for example, Elizabeth engaged with an organization studies scholar, Dan Shalimon, from my own department, and discussed discourse. And he gave his point of view, and then you use those points of view to discuss your own fieldwork experiences. Now that, to me, is really interesting, because it begins to get anthropology out of its little narrow niche, out of the anthropologists talking to one another, to the business school. And I think it's in the business schools that we will really make a mark in the future. And Timothy has a paper, don't you, which is also going to be, it's going to be in the next issue, but on marketing, sensory marketing, where we have a marketer, a very well-known marketer, who's going to comment on. So I'm looking to sort of push in that direction. That's probably enough.
Okay. Sure, no, that's fine. That's fine. That's okay. That's a good start.
There's sort of interesting things in China. and Japan, and probably some people know sort of Korea and Hong Kong. There's sort of, China is waiting to be colonized.
So to speak, right? Interesting answer.
Yes, it is. It's one way of putting it, isn't it? China is very interested in business anthropology. And the trouble is, at the moment, the person who is pushing it is, as far as I know, not really an anthropologist, as I understand.
An economist.
Is that what he is? Okay. But it is waiting for a possibility, and so my move to Hong Kong may result in sort of a bit of, yeah, it's nice to have a bit of sort of counter-colonialism.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned Japan as well, because we have two scholars, our disciples that are here from Shinzuoka University, and they didn't know I was going to call on them, but if I can, Keiko Yamaki, Chisako Takashima.
Okay.
Can you tell us anything about applied anthropology in Japan, just in 1 or 2 minutes? I'm sorry to put you on the spot like this. We did. This was not yet.
Well, the biggest not many people here, because I was living in Tokyo a few years ago. I remember that I was there, two of my friends, and Joe Macri, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And the rest of them are professionals. So you mentioned that 40% of accreditation in the United States is totally different situation in Japan. So, this time I'm really learning what is going on in the United States, and you have, you already have a specialist consulting job as a PhD holder, and we don't have different situations, so hopefully I'd like to train, I'm going to learn the curriculum of the university in the United States, and we like to make the best progress.
Right, great. So, Anne, there is some nice people you talk. So, thanks for doing that. I know that was not planned, so thank you for being here and letting me kick on you and take the weight off of Brian a little bit. Yes. But I agree with everything you say in terms of us needing to get better. Most of it. Let's go establishing those inward. And I think that's EPIC's doing a really good job of meeting physically. You gather in different places outside the U.S. I think that helps the dialogue.
Yes. Brazil next year.
I think it was interesting when I started the Journal of Business Anthropology, and well, it was your fault. You pushed me to become the editor. But when I started it, I actually got quite a lot of sort of strange reactions from Americans saying, "What? But you're in a business school in Denmark. Why? Why isn't it in America?" And I said, "Because you refuse to become my co-editor, because I'm looking for an American co-editor." Which is quite interesting. I had, you know, the people who were here didn't say this. But there were some who were not. That's all right, Bob. I didn't say it. It's okay, you haven't said anything yet. So there's someone not here who did have this reaction, which I thought was very interesting. And they were saying, you know, well, you want to move it out of Copenhagen to an American university.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah. Which is quite interesting.
Right.
By the way, good passing.
Now we're going to turn to Lenny, Lenora Boren. And if you want to quickly tell us title, workplace, and a summary of what you do, because I know you are in an academic setting without actually being a professor talking to students. Is that right?
That's right. Okay. Little more information? Okay. I'm Lenora Boren, and currently I'm the president of Napa. Here in the States, we can choose the Napa wine with a Napa auto parts store. There's more to Napa than what you see. What it stands for is an association for practicing, which you probably know that. And I only have 2 more hours. But besides that, I am at Colorado State University, and my background is in environmental anthropology. I've spent 30 plus years working with air quality, and I worked a lot with outdoor air quality, mobile sources, cars. We worked a lot with Europe. When it started, the U.S. was ahead as far as technology, but it ended up, Europe was by far ahead because they looked at the behavior of drivers as opposed to just technology. And then the U.S. technology was in charge. And slowly we're working on it, but Europe is by far ahead, particularly with mobile sources. So I was a director of a research group that did work. We had clean air conferences in Europe and here in the States for years, new research. More recently, I'm working for a group called the Institute of Built Environment, where I'm looking at sustainable and green building. And I work a lot with transportation, so I've done a lot with that, plus indoor air quality. And it's been really, really fun because it's so diverse and there's so many issues. I worked on several indoor air quality projects, one here in D.C., where we found that the most polluted building in Washington, D.C. was EPA. The environmental protection, you know, a little more complicated. And this was the Waterside Mall, for those of you who know it. Their new building is fine, but the old one, there was at least five people who could not go in that building because they were so sensitive. So again, I've worked a lot with engineers and with government agency, federal and state, with the air quality. So I've also worked with the Anthro department, but only teaching when somebody goes sabbatical or sometimes on campus courses or guest lecturing and that kind of thing. But at the university, I'm a research scientist as opposed to an academic. And we have, at CSU, we have several groups that do that. And which is fun because you get into everything. Most recently, it's climate change. So they're working a lot with climate change. But back to NAPA, which again, my experience has been mostly with practicing anthropologists or applied anthropologists. And most of you are very familiar with NAPA. You should be. They're hosting this. And they're also hosting a lot of Ebola sessions this week, today and tomorrow. And this was a last minute deal. So NAPA really likes to get into much different issues that are really important to anthropologists and journalists. Some more academic, some more practicing, but really across the board. Now the question that Terry was interested in is, what are the key issues?
All right, well, just I'll go back up a second, just okay. More context for Lenny. Lenny for years ran the workshop program for NAPA and then has spent 2 years as the president-elect and now the past 2 years as president. We'll spend 2 more years as past president.
Yes,
and then in that context then, what do you see as some of the key issues that have been raised, what are some of the things that practitioners talk about?
Well, some of the key issues for NAPA itself is to respond to issues like the Ebola and to be able to get information out there because people really want to know the latest that is happening and be kept up to touch right there and right now and what's taking them in the future. As far as the issues that come to us, probably the most common issue is career change. People come to NAPA like, okay, professionals want to get out of academia or perhaps into academia. Where do I go? How do I do it? What are my choices? You know, the hows. And they will often come to us because they kind of see us in that role. And we have done that for years. And part of the reason is because we have been doing the workshops. I was in charge, and more recently, Sabrina, sitting back in the corner, has been in charge, and we do workshops, and a lot of them end up being training-type workshops, skill changes. I ran some evaluation workshops for just a lot of people feel like evaluation is the next area to go into who are changing careers. So we try and respond to that, and some of the ways we do it are by workshops. The Career Expo that somebody mentioned earlier, we've been doing this 10 years. Next year will be the 10-year anniversary for doing the expo. And people really, really like it because they can talk to industry people about what are the opportunities out there. Mentoring. Somebody else mentioned mentoring earlier. And mentoring has been a huge piece of NAPA. And next year will be the 20th anniversary. And it's for mentoring through NAPA. No, 25th. No, 20th is what?
What's that?
That's what Neil told me.
1990.
I just said, well, I know. Neil told me we have to have our yeah. But Elizabeth is a past president, so we better update Neil. Yeah. I did chat with Neil today. I didn't ask him that question, but he said the most mentoring is graduate students. They get undergraduates and definitely professionals, but the most calls we have for mentoring are graduate students. They really don't know where to go, how to get started. Here they've been in school for longer. They really don't know how to get started. They don't know what the choices is. What are the avenues? And then through our mentoring program, we send out emails to anybody we ever knew who might be in a field they're interested in to start working for them. So help, looking for help is a huge issue. We also encourage them to do things like check on social media, because there's a lot on social media that was not there before. And that's another avenue to figure out where to go with their lives. There's networking events. Sabrina is hosting a networking event tomorrow where they can go and meet people at meetings like this. But also, even within their disciplines, try and find out who's doing what, when, where, and how. That's what we spend most of our time doing, and that's where the major questions come up. Two things really come up. How do I get a job? We're going to get training for it, and that's what our workshops do sometimes, at least give them an idea of their choices. And then, what are the choices out there? And one of the things that we really tell a lot of people is to be an applied practicing anthropologist, you have to be an opportunist. And that means you don't close any doors, you look at what's out there, and you may find an opportunity. So it's mainly career change.
Great. Okay. And we're going to move now to Elizabeth Bridie, and I would just use her unabashedly. MEVA is a volunteer-based organization, and people like Elizabeth exemplify that. She was a president years ago when she was a mere teenager and has remained involved for years with MEVA. So we need you to join and be part volunteer. I see many faces in here, past volunteers, could be chairs, those folks. We can find a role for you that dovetails with what you want to do. So please, you know, volunteer coordinator, see me, see Lenny, see anybody that is with MAPA, and we will get you plugged in. But it's because of the efforts of particular people like Elizabeth and other people in here that MAPA drives. Elizabeth, you have the unfortunate position of going last and being sort of titled workplace and a bit of a summary of what you do, and then we'll go to your question.
Okay, well, in the Paleolithic, I worked at Denver Motors for almost 24 years, and I was a researcher there and spent my time looking at and addressing employee-related work issues. So I worked with engineers, manufacturing people, people in sales offices, et cetera, et cetera. And at the time of GM bankruptcy in 2009, I left GM, and I started doing exactly what I had been doing in GM outside of GM, only I started my own firm called Cultural Keys, and I work now not just in automotive, but in many other industries, insurance, medical, apparel, nonprofit, it doesn't matter. And my work involves helping organizations solve problems that they have. So I'm an organizational culture and change expert, I guess you would say. That's what I love to do. I love people. I love being in part of in organizations and working with people on the issues that they face. And my most favorite thing in the world to do, without question, is being in a manufacturing plant. I love it. And just 2 weeks ago, I got a chance, I've been in a million GM plants, but I got a chance to go to a dog food plant. Yeah. And I was so happy. I felt like I could come home. So anyway, that's a little bit about me. I think your question is...
You get the summary question, yeah, which is considering the past when you were president of MAP, and now a lot of the comments you've heard and other things, and being an instant mentor and those sorts of things, what do you see as the key issues in ensuring a strong future for the discipline?
Well, I think to answer that question, I have to switch back and forth between what I have experienced within NAPA and now what I am experiencing at the AAA leadership level, because I'm now on the AAA board as the practicing professional seat. And I will say I'm the only professional anthropologist on the board, so I'm hoping that more of you will, you know, step up to the plate in the future and join the, you know, put your name in the hat and run for positions. I know some of you have done that this last time around. It's a little lonely up there being the only practitioner. So I guess the first thing I'd like to say is look how far we've come. NAPA was created in 1983. We now have, you know, a very strong body of people who form the core of it and have been participants in that core for a very long time. We have worked on many, many initiatives that have been amazingly successful. So let me just name a few of them. Several have come up. One is EPIC, getting that organization off the ground and running. Another was the NAPA Careers Video, which then became the AAA Careers Video. And since then, two more videos have been added, you know, to the AAA, you know, promotion effort that helps both students and their parents understand what you can do with an anthropological career, anthropological training. We have the mentor program, which started back in 1990. Yeah, no, it's really been going strong. And the reason why I know the date is because I've had an opportunity now that I'm on the AAA board since June to work on a mentoring working group, which basically took stock of all of the mentoring that's going on within the association by what was available on websites, through interviews, through other documents that we had access to. And NAPA's program by far is absolutely stellar. It is not just that it is the oldest mentoring program in the AAA, but it is the most robust. And even in terms of the number of slides we had to devote to it, it's amazing. It has the mentor match associated with it, which pairs individuals with people who can provide them with guidance and career advice. It now has the frequently asked questions, or the so-called FAQs, which are listed on the NAPA website, which are particularly useful for undergraduate students, but also for graduate students and those who are in career transition. Another aspect of what NAPA has done. NAPA was extremely interested back in the early and mid 1980s in the LPO initiative, local practitioner organizations, headed up by Linda Bennett, and she wrote a nice little NAPA bulletin, which have now transformed into the NAPA Annals of Anthropological Practice, I guess they're called. And Linda's work on the LPOs has now blossomed into yet another new initiative, headed up by Derek Newbury, and that, thanks to Greg's excellent training, to be really focused on more virtual communities and how we can, you know, participate in a local practitioner organization, but do so virtually rather than face-to-face, you know, co-located in the same place. NAPA was the first organization to have a practitioner directory, even have a directory. And they did that not just with NAPA members, but by partnering with the Society for Applied Anthropology. So, I mean, these are just some of the many initiatives that NAPA has done over the years, and they keep getting better and filling a gap. There's always a gap that we're trying to fill. So I think that's one thing. Now that I'm on the AAA executive board, I'm happy to say that I have had a very surprisingly pleasant time. And I say that in all sincerity, because I didn't expect it to be that way. I expected that it would be kind of, you know, businessy and administrative and, you know, kind of long and drawn out. And I wasn't really sure of who these other people were around the table. I did not know any of them, except for the past president, Mullins. I did meet her. But I didn't know anybody else around the table. And very quickly I got to know this very large group of other members and found them to be exceedingly receptive to practice, which also surprised me, because throughout my history as part of being in the AAA, I have not always felt as well received. So I was pleasantly surprised by that, and the mentoring report, which was completed on Halloween, was, quote, received. That just means that they have taken the report. They have not adopted anything in it yet, though they immediately started talking about the 11 recommendations and who would work on those recommendations. And those recommendations include, you know, getting other sections, not just NAPA and the three other sections that we're doing mentoring, as well as the AAA Leadership Fellows Program, to get the other sections to consider mentoring. And, oh, by the way, here are five models of mentoring. If you don't like these, do a hybrid or do something else. But think about mentoring your students, because your students will need that. A lot of it has gone on, of course, in the academic departments, but so many come to the AAA meetings and are looking for assistance with trying to figure out what do they do next and how do they do that. And they're not getting that, particularly with respect to career development. They're not getting that in the academic institutions as a rule. I'm saying this very broadly and generally. Of course, there are individuals who try to help and so on, but as a rule, they're not getting that, and they come here to these meetings, and they take the NAPA workshops, they go to the Careers Expo, they find you, you know, if you have had any association with NAPA, and they ask you questions, and that's great, but it also shows that we are filling a very important need that is not being filled elsewhere, I think. Someone mentioned... Brian mentioned, you know, we got to break out of anthropology in a lot of ways and start connecting much more specifically with, could be other organizations, could be with the general public, could be with government and other kinds of business entities that are out there. I will say that I served on a review panel for a climate change report that was led by Shirley Fisk, another former NAPA president. The report was received at the most recent meeting a couple of days ago, and now the question will be, what do we do with that report? And it's been my push on the board to get the board to think about this thing not as a done deal, here's the report, but, okay, we have this nice report, foundational work, no question about it. Yeah, it could be tweaked. Yeah, we can get the jargon out of it. But what do we do with it now? And that kind of raises the stakes, because now you have to think about who should hear what we've learned through this report, and how do they get that information? How do we go to broadcast media? Do we go to print media? Do we go to online media? Do we hit up public policy people? Do we go to Congress? What do we do with the report? And that takes it to a whole new level, that the AAA has to learn how to, you know, make their way. So yes, we have media people. Yes, we have press people. Yes, we have communications people. But now we are at the cusp, I think, of really thinking very carefully and very seriously about how we move forward, so that we're not just talking to each other, but we are really taking a report that was generated by a cross-section of the association who know something about climate change, and we've created this thing, so now what do we do? And that's kind of where we're at the moment on that particular thing, but I raised that as just an example of where the AAA is at and what I think needs to happen next. That we really have to have a set of decisions about what do we want to be in the next 5 years, 10 years, and so on any number of issues. So this is not just talking to ourselves, it's engaging with existing people working, in this case, on climate change, and figuring out, well, what can we do together? And here's what we know. How can we help you? How can you help us so that we make a stronger position on that? Another point, now going back to the discipline, is that I think that the discipline of anthropology in general, which has been largely a scholarly and academic association and discipline, is changing. I mean, we've known this for a few decades now, but it is now very much a mixed association and a mixed discipline. We have academics, we have practitioners, and we have those who float back and forth across that divide. I know that when I first became a member of the association, which the association told me I think was in 84, which I didn't remember, but they did, I felt very different. I mean, here I was, you know, a young PhD out of Greg's program at UT Austin, and I felt like I was an anomaly. You know, I had a PhD, but so what? I worked for this company called General Motors, and people thought, you know, very strange things about me because I wasn't like them. I was very different. And so over the years, I and many of my colleagues here in Napa have experienced that same kind of feeling because of being so different, because of doing what we do. We do, I think, very, very well, but we do things in a different way with different kinds of people for different reasons, most notably that we're trying to solve problems and affect the world in ways that can only be done if there is a specific problem to solve. And so I think that that in general is now changing, partly because of this incredible increase in the number of MAs that are coming out of master's programs like Anne's, but many other master's level programs, where those young professionals now are finding work in various walks of life, but not necessarily in academia, certainly not as tenure track, not at an MA level. And so that is helping sort of change the tide. The other thing that's helping is that there are more practitioners now among those of us who are at least part of NAPA and who are engaged in so many aspects of the association's life. I mean, we're on all the committees, and this has been a NAPA strategy for a long time now to identify, all right, who would be a good practitioner to sit on, name your favorite committee, you know, the ethics committee or the gender equity committee or the finance committee or whatever. And so we've had this this incredible push, I think, among internal push among ourselves to get people that we know who are competent in those substantive areas to get out there and do the work of the association, and that has been extremely helpful. I think that we need to now really call attention when distinctions are made between professional anthropologists and academic anthropologists. I think we need to call people on it. And we need to say, you know what? We need to talk about not me and you or us and them, but us, all of us, as a single group. We are the association. It is true we are all different, but hey, we're different ages. We come from different places. Yeah, I do stuff in organizations. You do stuff in a university. You do stuff in NGOs. We're all us. We're not just, you know, a practitioner versus an academic. And I think that there are many people that have served as bridges over the last several decades that we can learn from because they are role models. So now I'm going to name some names. There are people who own their own consulting firms and who also work in academia. And some of those people include Marianne and Julia Gleason, who is not here, Ken Erickson, who is not here. Julia works in an engineering faculty. Ken works in a business school, Marianne works in an anthropology department, but all three are CEOs or presidents of their own firms. Okay, so that's one type of bridge. A second type of bridge are the people who've worked in industry for many years and have now moved back into academia. And we have a couple of examples. We've got Tim right here, who was at BBVO, and before that at Darcy in Detroit, and now is at Fordham. And then, of course, we have Susan Squires, who worked for many different kinds of high-tech industries, including GVO, and started at Arthur Andersen, ended up at Ericsson, then at Intel, and now she's teaching at UNT, where Anne comes from. So a different kind of a bridge where there were industry and now back in academia. Okay, and then there are people like Anne and Tomoko, and they are people who are primarily based in academia, but who consult. Okay, so they get out of the university, right? And they do work, and there may be many others of you who have done that as well, but these are the ones that I know of and have good examples from. And then there are other people who own their own firms and work in those firms for their regular jobs. Inga is one. Anthropology Imagination. Kevin Prester is another. Patty Sunderland and Rita Denny with their Practica group. Bob Moraes with his marketing firm. All of these people, I think, are very important role models, but also bridges for us. And then the second to the last group, I would say, are the full-time employees who work in organizations, and those include people like Robert Hahn, Melissa Sefkin, Adam Coons right here, and many more who come to the association because of their expertise as a full-time employee and bring that knowledge to us. And then the last group, of course, are all of us who are part of NAPA, who seamlessly move from one arena to another, seemingly without too much stress. So we're, you know, how do we think about, what's my question again? It was, what were the key issues?
So long,
yeah. Ensuring a strong future for the discipline. Well, I think that we, first of all, have to collaborate more, not less. And that means that we have to create more bridges and different kinds of bridges and work harder to reduce the distinctions that sometimes still appear within the association. And I picked especially on this practitioner versus academic distinction, but there are many others. That's just the one that, you know, sort of rings true to NAPA. So I think we have to collaborate more, and I think we also have to problem solve more. And by problem solving, I mean that there are many problems out there in the big world, and we are in here, and, you know, as we were saying, we need to break out of anthropology and start tackling some of those big problems. So if we don't cooperate, if we don't, stop this nonsense about deciding who's in which camp, we're not going to make much progress. And I think we also need to enhance our own skill sets so that when the media calls, you've got to be ready. You've got to, you know, so as an example, I got a call from somebody at the Kansas City affiliate of NPR, and they said, well, we want to do this this little program on dress. Do you think you could help us? And I said, well, what do you mean by dress? And they said, well, corporate dress, like what people wear to work. And I'm thinking, okay, yeah, sure, I'll help you out with that. And so, you know, when they call, you got to answer. And so I prepared some things. I knew a little bit about corporate dress. And then, you know, the interview took place, and I was paired against this other guy who came from a fancy, like Calvin Klein, one of those big brands. And it was a very interesting discussion between, you know, me looking at it from a cultural perspective and this other guy looking at it from a fashion perspective. You've got to be there and ready. To take the lead, and you know, I had to leave my comfort zone a little bit. You know, I mean, corporate dress, but I did that, and I think that's what we have to do a lot more of. We have to be out there educating people, I think, for for who we are and how we can help.
We have a plethora of ideas and information that's come out. Let's see, we are at, is it 7 o'clock? 8 o'clock? Is it 8 o'clock?
Okay.
I was going to say, okay. Thank you all for doing this, and I hope, and thank you for coming, and I hope that we will not wait 10 years to do this again. Does anyone on the panel have any questions they want to throw out? I have the option of throwing questions at you, and do you have things you want to ask of each other? Or
I had a question for you. You said that EPIC works with industry and business, but what about, I mean, what you can use the same approaches and skills for NGOs and nonprofits, I would think. So, but you only mentioned the seemingly the for-profits.
There are nonprofits there, but it's primarily for industry.
What
practices in industry conference? Probably because there are so many anthropologists working in industry, and it just came about because anthropologists wanted to talk about what they do. But the focus has been on industry people in industry, people getting jobs in industry, talking about what we do primarily.
Well, it seems unfortunate to me to follow up on what Elizabeth just said, to, you know, for solving problems, the same issues and the same skills would be applicable. So,
but it's open to anyone, so yeah. It's not selective.
We have a little buzz happening here. We're not like on that page. We're thinking EPIC is about organizational work, about enterprise.
Right.
And agency people have been there and have participated and been speakers. So.
Right. So
and they're invited.
Typically with the purpose of change. So, again, I use that idea of disruptive thinking, forward thinking. But yeah, EPIC is open to anyone. And next year it's going to be in Brazil. So it tries to be non-US centric.
Are we going to make it cheaper for students?
Student volunteer.
I apologize for the CDC reference. CDC is the Centers for Disease Control.
Anybody have a question? Now, we're supposed to be done at 8:15, but I don't think anyone is in this room. And Lenny has to go. I have to go. But any of you who want to carry on a dialogue, please don't feel like you have to get up and go. It would be great to carry on. But anybody have questions? If you do, just raise your hand or shout out and just identify yourself and then ask your question so they know who you are.
No one else raised their hand. I have a reflection. And hearing this, you know, you're on the executive board in the practicing role, and I was on that role also 10 years ago before I was the NAPA president. And so here we're reflecting upon practicing in the last decades and into the future. But one of our main objectives then, in my working on the, when I landed on the executive board, was I did feel that hostility. Yeah. And actually, the voice of the practitioners were, when they would come to the AAA, they wouldn't find a place here. There wasn't things for them to do, and they weren't coming. And so our main objectives, I spent a year doing just an observation, learning their budgets and the organization of the AAA. In my second year, I put a whole list together, said these are the kinds of things we need to do to get the practitioners here. And so the expo happened, many different things to open up places. So that, like this meeting today, look how many people we have here and enthusiastic, mm-hmm. and you're reflecting on that we feel welcome here now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think there's been a substantive change since I've been coming.
It's worth noting that when
because now the executive director of AAA right now is mm-hmm. practicing in the car.
And that just shows in 30 years, because when NAPA was founded, it was not without heavy controversy within the association. Mm-hmm. There was lots of pushback. Is not a universally welcomed, but the fact that departments are graduating half of their PhD not been able to get a job, they fully realize we have to do something.
Well, Nikki, what do you think? When you were president,
so this is Nikki Irish. She's a president, past president of NAPA as well, and right. Chicago. origins.
And I'm a little bit of an outlier because I work in human services as a researcher. I have an academic affiliation. I have worked at a medical school. But I wanted to raise my hand and say there is a whole other set, a whole other world about, which is in the nonprofit human services arena. And there are lots of anthropologists doing that. There aren't very many people doing what I do, but because I work in the aging field. And my work has been with sort of the fringes. I do a lot of work in the field of elder abuse and guardianship. Well, it's not guardianship anymore, but a lot of work in elder abuse. And that's quite different. So I work in a large social service organization, which have the Research Institute, which is quite unique. And I went there because they serve about 20,000 people a year, unduplicated count. And everything from community living, independent community living, through nursing home care, transportation, home delivery meals, you name it, counseling, et cetera. So it's a wonderful, and I always called it a sort of a living laboratory for looking at developing programs, testing programs, but doing both more academic type research as well as very, very applied. But my thoughts are, and then the other field we really didn't touch on is the whole medical field and policy. And all the anthropologists here in Washington, particularly, but locally as well, who work in government agencies and make policy and help shape policy. We have a great investment, AAA has a great investment in policy and public anthropology, but it's not really seen. And so it is seen here in D.C. through WAPA and people sitting up here, but that's a whole other set of opportunities for people to be thinking about. I want to go back to something that Anne was talking about, in whether there are externship opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And develop NAPA developing opportunities in that area. We've had many interns in my program from different schools in the Chicago area, but we've never had really any kind of, well, DePaul University now has a Master's in Public Health program, and we get a student for the better part of an academic year from the Adler Institute of Professional Psychology, or whatever it's called. And so we've done that, but boy, I would really love to have to have had anthropology. So I'm no longer the director of research, I retired, but we would love to have, I can still influence that and have people from programs apply programs in, you know, like the one in Memphis, which does have a medical orientation, and have and support externships. And I think that might be a NAPA initiative that's a little more, it's a little more than a class project.
Mm-hmm.
But it would fulfill for students where that's not an option, it might fulfill the same thing, and they could receive credit for that. So building collaborations with academic programs that way, I think, might be very helpful. What else would you, I don't know what else to say.
Something that wasn't on your list of NAPA first is the NAPA Occupational Therapy Field School in Guatemala, where the AAA is actually working with the profession to train the anthropologists.
It's really not a NAPA program, though. We supported it.
It was started off as a special interest group under NAPA.
Yes, it did, because that was the way they could affiliate. But it's still going on. And it's in, so, yeah, that's true. There is that program. And there have been a lot of initiatives. I think there have been a lot of things to do this. What I think is most heartening is Elizabeth's experience now, finally, perhaps, moving beyond the nobody loves us position, which was just rampant. I mean, you could not get people off of that.
They were begging me, honestly, begging me to come up with a bunch of people who were done for AAA executive board and all the AAA committees. And there were,
I think there were 14 open slots this past time, and many of them, I don't remember how many, were specifically for practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
But let me comment. We had a committee. We had a committee, and we brought Elizabeth in, which was really good. But before that, we still had always put names on Kathleen's committee, but they wouldn't win.
Yeah.
So, and now we're seeing more of them win, because we all, whenever there was a practitioner slot, put a name up.
Right.
But we would often not win. And it's very...
Now we put on more and names for...
Yeah, I mean, well, because it's a self-nomination, it's done differently.
Right.
Beforehand, we could only give them one name.
Yeah.
Now, because of that, we can have maybe four or five practitioners.
And
one of them...
Interesting. I was president at the time of the section assembly, sort of, that started.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just starting, but it was new, relatively new. And it was interesting because NAPA always worked very hard to put up candidates for seats. And we always did. And other sections never did. It was a real eye-opener to me. How
today in the section assembly, NAPA is one of two who did that. So it's still true.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's a great opportunity there. And
okay. Let's. We have a question. Do you have a question? Okay. And then
I'm new to NAPA, and I, in an effort to sort of address the graduate student needs, and also I think those who have gone beyond graduate school and want to make a career change, I was on the NAPA website. Are there video tutorials or kind of like I'm thinking like Khan Academy or you know, just short segments by people to, you know, do a tutorial on, you know, or talk about a software program or methods or that kind of thing.
Right now, all we have are, we're building an archive. We've had a series of interviews with folks that has gone on for the past 8 months, let's say. That was on our LinkedIn page, Al was on the blog, and we have six or eight podcasts of people just interviewing them, but nothing specific like that. So
may I suggest that also to take a tip from like the coding academies that are popping up. People are interested in building their skill sets. LinkedIn, you know, you designate a skill and people endorse you kind of thing, but NAPA can be a resource for people outside of anthropology to gain a skill within research. I work in Silicon Valley. Research is popping up all over the place. And the design school at the D school at Stanford, you know, is really pushing the importance of user-centered research and all that. And I think NAPA can be a great resource in showing what specifically anthropology, even theories too, not just methods, but general theories of to apply to these kinds.
It would be good if you and Terry could talk.
Submit something on our contact us page if you and I don't happen to speak and articulate that, and I can then disseminate that also.
Mm-hmm.
That would be very helpful.
Good idea.
Let me ask a question of everybody. Mickey pointed out that we're kind of really foolish or ambitious with this, trying to cram a lot into a short time. There's obviously a lot we didn't get to. Are there things that you didn't hear that you came to hear that you want to bring up? We obviously missed, and we did miss huge swaths of what practitioners do. Jenny, identify yourself.
That's a hard question. I thought we were going to be talking about the future of anthropology, what was going to be needed in the future, what it was going to look like, I guess, more than what was going to be needed.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a 20-year look. 50-year look, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been talking pretty much about what's going on now.
The conversation has sort of evolved. Does anybody want to guess what we're going to look like 50 years from now?
Very old.
Well, I personally think that we're going to be much more engaged in organizational work of some kind. I think that we've been in communities forever. Various kinds of communities, and I see that there is a shift that's moving to organizational work, and for some reason that was really not on people's radar for decades, but now is a growing area in which anthropologists are working, not just for business, but organizations, NGOs, you know, inside hospitals, not just studying healthcare disparity out in the community, but now they're in the hospitals figuring out how care is being delivered, as an example. So I think organizational work is where anthropology is going.
I was going to say another change. Being in a business school, it's amazing to me how many anthropologists now are working in business schools. There's nobody has talked about how business schools are changing. The whole focus in business has become much more humanistic. Sustainability, proactive marketing or purpose-based marketing, these are new ideas coming out where companies like Whole Foods, Patagonia, that show they're giving back are the new models for how businesses are functioning. So this is becoming now ways to teach, and corporations are hiring business leaders who are sensitive to these. So unbelievable the response to humanistic responses, cultural responses to how to better train future leaders. So that's part of it. I think there'll be more anthropologists shaping business practices from the educational point of view.
And let me just, I've got two questions here, and just put this in the back of our head. Right now, the federal government, as far as I know, is the largest employer of non-academically based anthropologists. So is that going to remain 20 years from now, or are people, as we shift away from having enough academic jobs? And I think Microsoft is supposed to be the second one. This is all identical, so I don't know. But Nikki?
Part of that vision isn't that's thinking about what is going to change in academia for students. What will academic institutions look like in 20 years? And how will they be responding to changing demographics, to the change in goals and expectations for people? We have great disparities now economically, so will we have great disparities in education? We have a rising not-for-profit sector in higher education, and how will that affect what we do as anthropologists coming through that system?
Right.
So I think
that's
we have to
point.
Think about that.
But Anne and Christine.
Okay. When I first started coming to the AAA a long, long, long time ago, there was so much hand-wringing about anthropology is irrelevant. How do we show people we're not irrelevant? It was all about we appear to be irrelevant. And, you know, I just think that is not the case anymore. Globalization, which is the way of the 21st century, has made anthropology relevant in every single area. And so I think jobs in non-government are going to increase. I mean, there's no way that anthropologists can't be relevant in the 21st century, given the connectedness of the world. So I think we have, you know, we have jobs forever. Well, we have jobs for forever, really. And it's just a matter of, and people see that more and more. So I think the future is, we're no longer irrelevant. The future is much brighter for anthropology. We have found our niche. Globalization is our niche.
Christine, could you tell us a little bit about who you are as well before?
My name is Chris Miller, and I spent 7 years teaching at a design school in Savannah. Hosted EPIC a couple years ago, and currently teaching in a business school at IIT, which is a technology research institution. I wanted to respond to the question about the future, and I was at several panels this year where all the panelists were graduate students, right? I mean, the chair, you know, they might have a professional or faculty chair, but the kinds of topics that these graduate students are looking at are not the kinds of things that we typically have looked at, like citizen science, biohacking, Internet of Things. I mean, I think we have to, like, plug into what, you know, the graduate students are doing to understand what the future of anthropology is going to look like, because I think we're guessing, whereas they're probably not. So, you know, but I mean, working with students, we get a feel for that, but I think I was really impressed with the quality, the thoughtfulness, and that the fact that as anthropologists, one of our jobs is to critique, you know, to problematize in a business school. Like CSR, what is this all about?
Okay. Kind of reinforcing that 30 years ago I wrote a column for the Anthropology News. My title was, Does Anthropology Apply? And the title was an intentional double entendre because I was saying that there's a lot of opportunities out there, but anthropologists weren't applying. Now, I think that has changed greatly, but I think your point is excellent that our students are really better antennae for what's going on out there than we are. And so our challenge as educators is to encourage and support and figure, okay, that sounds great. Here's some ways to equip yourself to make a difference there.
Great.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm Tomoko Hamada, Connery, and recently I got really into activist role. So I'm doing academia, but also trying to change Japanese society. Big stuff. But my point is, for future 20 years from now, you know, anthropologists are always hired as a specialist in a way in the organization, but I think it's time for us to educate future leaders, you know, so we know the CEOs and the new enterprises popping up. These are not the today's enterprise, very different enterprise, creative industries, you know, IT is one side, globalization. So I think our curriculum also has to put this new leadership type of things, because I jumped into this, it's a hot fire, but it's worth doing it, and I think the next generation of graduate students are going to do that.
I have a comment as a graduate student, and I am in the University of North Texas MPH, MS, Biology program. I think, and bringing it back to NAPA, is I think it's very important to continue to engage students in the AAAs, because of our department, which is, I don't know, you probably know better than I, 35 students-ish, two of us are here, and I'm not presenting, I'm just attending. So we have one presenter from our program, and I have several of the students from South Florida who also don't go, and they only go to the SFAs or another conference because they feel ganged up upon. And so I think making it known that there's a community at AAA that's welcoming is really, really important to continue to engage within, you know, the larger discipline of anthropology.
Thank you for that. Thank you for that. We have reached time, and I have to flee, and I don't know if any of our panelists can stick around, but please feel free to continue the dialogue if you have to go. Great, thank you for coming, and thanks again to our panel. It was great.
Thank you for organizing. Thank you.